Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, my friends, and welcome to Idle Chatter. Ray Bohax here, coming to you from snowy Cat Swamp Road in Warren County, New Jersey. And I know a lot of parts of the country are being hit with a snow and ice storm, and so are we here. And temperatures hovering just around 33, 34 degrees. We're getting a good deal of ice. They're saying all different amounts of snow, so who knows? I guess anything between 0 and 12 inches, right? So I'll let you know tomorrow when it's over. But I hopefully things are going well for you guys and everyone that is listening, and that you had a good week and you're excited about this new week, right? And this show usually will be posted on Wednesday, as I say, so you're probably already midweek if you were to listen to it when it's posted. But whenever you listen to it, I hope that you're having a great, 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 great week. I came across some interesting tidbits about Warren County, where we farm, and I wanted to share them with you. I'm going to round the numbers. You know, I'm on Twitter as far as social media is concerned. I'm not on anything else, and I wasn't involved with that prior to starting the podcast and the website, and I've enjoyed it. I'm not enamored with it, but I enjoy it. It's fun, and I met a lot of great people, and a lot of those people actually came to see me last year at the Firestone booth at Commodity Classics. So I was very happy about that. But what I did is I put a survey up on Twitter about a month or so ago, and what I have found, you know, coming from the East Coast, that we have, in relative terms, small farms. Not as small as they would have in Japan, but compared to the people out west and in the Midwest, we have small acreage. And I was always very interested when I speak to someone who is a fellow farmer about how large their operation is. And I've noticed over time that I probably have a 50% rate of people that seem to feel uncomfortable when I ask them how many acres they farm. And I'm only asking that because it's, you know, coming from the East Coast, somebody says to me they farm 2,000, 3,000, 10,000 acres. I'm just in awe of that. And what I did find is that some people take, I don't know, I want to say they become guarded when I say that. And other people, you know, are very open. So, oh, we farm 5,000 acres. We farm 10,000 acres. So I put a survey out on Twitter a few weeks ago. And it came back that 60% of the people that responded to the survey, I think I had 607 responses or 600 replies to the survey, and a little bit more than 60%, let's say 60%, felt that was improper for a stranger to ask how many acres someone farms. And I was kind of taken back by that. Excuse me. And it seems to be that the people on the East Coast don't seem to mind it. It seems that the guys with the larger acreage, about 60% of them, find that offensive. And I found it very, very interesting. So from now on, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to ask anybody how many acres they farm. And like I say, it's not doesn't have anything to do with you know, counting someone's money or counting their business. But it's just, like I say, for me, it's being in awe of such, being a steward of such large land masses. And then also, I think that it gives a, you know, it gives a better idea of, you know, how I could communicate with the person. You know, if they're farming larger acres or smaller acres, I could ask them questions or how they do this or that, whatever. But hey, it takes all kinds to make the world go round. But to that point, I just recently, something came in the mail. It had nothing to do with agriculture. We're in Warren County, as I say in the intro, Warren County, New Jersey, and I guess there's some kind of newsletter or something goes around. But I found out some interesting facts about Warren County that I did not know. And I wanted to share them with you. And Warren County is, there's 21 counties in New Jersey, and Warren County is number 19 in population. So there's two counties that have less population than we do in New Jersey. And, you know, keep in mind that New Jersey is the most densely populated state in the country. So to be the 19th out of 21, I think that's pretty good and pretty rural. And so we have two major, I won't call them cities, towns in Warren County. One is Hackettstown, which is outside of where our farm is, right outside of Hackettstown, about 3 or 4 miles away. And that probably has a population of about 12,000 to 13,000 people, Hackettstown per se. And then we're out a few miles outside of Hackettstown, so we're out in the country. And then there's another large town called Phillipsburg. And they actually used to make locomotives there, and Ingersoll Rand was there years ago, and sadly it's not. And there was it's right on the Delaware River, Phillipsburg. And on the other side of the river is Easton, Pennsylvania. So it was Phillipsburg, Easton, Pennsylvania. So they were like Minneapolis, St. Paul, that they were sister cities. And a lot of people worked back and forth or lived on one side of the bridge and went to the other. But anyway, so that's a pretty large population over in Phillipsburg. It's much larger than it is than Hackettstown. But anyway, so to make a long story short, what I did find out that Warren County is, and I'm rounding these numbers, all of Warren County is approximately 240,000 acres. And, you know, there's people who have ranches out west that are larger than that, but 240,000 acres. But what I did enjoy reading is that approximately 80,000 acres of that 240,000 of Warren County are farmed. So that's actually pretty good. And then about 70,000 acres a forest, and about 30,000 acres of swamp. So if you were to add those all up, that Warren County in itself is very, very rural, and the whole county has, I think, 330,000 people in it. So that is the whole county. But I was very happy to hear that there's approximately 80,000 acres farmed in Warren County. And because of the 70,000 acres of forest land in the county, we have a multitude of wildlife. I know on our farm, we have a lot of bears, black bears. I mean, we have everything else. We have coyotes. We have fox. We have, they claim that there's some mountain lions. I've never seen any mountain lions. We have, you know, the normal raccoons, everything else, turtles, snapping turtles, what have you. So, well, I guess I'm pretty blessed to be living in this little utopia of agricultural community in Warren County outside of Hackettstown. So I just figured I would share that with you. And please know, if I ever do meet you and I happen to forget and ask how many acres you farm, just know that it's in awe of the stewardship that God has given you with that big piece of land. I'm not going to look at counting anybody's money or anything. So that is basically it. Now, what I wanted to talk to you about today also is two things. Well, first, I want to tell you what our subject is. The subject of this week's show is going to be tuning up the modern light-duty diesel. And I'm going to emphasize the light-duty, meaning like a pickup truck type of diesel, and not going to go into farm tractors, what have you. But the light-duty diesel in trucks is probably the most complicated diesel in pickup trucks that you're going to find out there. So we will talk about the tune-up on that. But prior to that, I want to introduce a new segment to the show. And this is going to come about every week. And it's going to be called Bushels and Cents, C-E-N-T-S. So I want to welcome you, and it's going to be in the beginning of the show, so I want to welcome you to Bushels and Cents. It is a new addition to each week's show, as I said. I want to truly drive home the message that success on the farm or ranch is a three-legged stool. That is agronomy or animal husbandry, marketing, and machinery. I feel the best way is to take real-life scenarios and establish how a poor decision or an inaccurate diagnosis, we've all made those, of a machinery issue costs your operation money. But instead of referencing just dollars, I will reference it in crop, corn at $3.50 a bushel. My hope is that this comparison in bushels drives home the point to my listeners and establishes that applying the lessons taught on Idle Chatter and on the Farm Machinery Digest website, so don't forget to go there, you will make your operation more profitable. I know that everyone listening does not grow corn, so please convert the example to current prices for the commodity or crop that you raise. And never forget, it is not what you make, but what you keep that counts. So now we're going to have an example. You do not fluid test the hydraulic system before planting season. So you're not fluid testing the hydraulic system on your tractor. The pump fails and you miss the optimum planting window by 5 days waiting for the new part. Reference from university data, each day past the ideal planting date impacts yield by 0.5%, so a half a percent. With a national average yield of 170 bushels per acre, this is corn, this would be a hit of 2.5%. So that's a half a percent multiplied by 5 days, or 4.25 bushels per acre. If you plant 1,000 acres of corn, then the potential yield loss would be 4,250 bushels, or $14,875. The cost of the repair would still be the same, but it would have been performed before planting season, since the failure would have been predicted by a $25 fluid analysis. By not fluid testing, it costs you nearly $15,000. Let this not be you. You ready? Enough said. So that's going to be a new segment every week that's going to come into the show, and we will be using that to drive home the point that it is very, very important for you to be able to have efficiency in your farm shop if you want to have a truly profitable operation. So we are going to be including that, and hopefully you like it. Alrighty. So let me get my papers here together, and I had to clear my throat. You know, we have an eclectic audience, and there's all different ages that are listening and all different types of agricultural operations. And I came of age when, and I was always, I was as awkward as could be as a kid. So I know a lot of people listening out there are really good sports people. They played football, they played baseball, basketball, all those things. Forget about it. I played absolutely nothing. I'm nearsighted in one eye, I'm farsighted in the other, I have terrible depth perception, and I'm totally uncoordinated as far as that's concerned. But put me behind the steering wheel, or put me behind a piece of machinery, and I'm a completely different person. I've become an athlete with that machinery. But on my own, I'm a klutz, all right? Forget about it. And I'm not gonna candy coat it, I am. So I was always the kid that no one ever wanted to pick, or when they made teams in you know, like in elementary school, the teachers say, okay, let's form teams. We're going to play softball. We're going to play kickball, dodgeball, whatever they called it. I like dodgeball, actually, maybe because that's the name of a car in it. But that was the kid that the teacher always had to force on a team, because they would pick everybody. Well, I want Joey. I want Sam. I want Frank. And then Ray would be standing off on the side like a lost puppy dog, and then no one would want me. And to tell you the truth, or the truth be told, that I probably would have preferred that they didn't, that the teacher just let me set it on the side. I didn't think of that as a penalty of being left out, that I was not good at sports, so not being good at something and being forced to do it is no fun. But I was always into machinery, always into agriculture, always into cars, into motors and what have you. And because of that, I always would read adult material, you know, Popular Mechanics, Popular Science, Hot Rod Magazine, what have you. So the point that I'm making here is that I was automotive and machinery aware at a very young age. It doesn't make me, I'm saying, I'm any smarter than anybody else, but whereas most children were not interested in that at 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, I was. So that is something where what it in essence does is give me a very broad background that doesn't coordinate with my age. because some younger people got into machinery, got into cars when they're 16, 17, 18 years old. I already had 10 or 12 years into it of reading about it, you know, looking at it, studying it, being involved with my dad with machinery. So I came of automotive age, machinery age, very, very young in my life, when I was very young. So I remember very distinctly that when the farm engine started to transition from gasoline to diesel power, and then in the 1960s, I would say, because I wasn't born in the 50s, so in the 60s and 70s, where you would be, it would be hard to get a gasoline-powered tractor, gasoline-powered. Actually, a neighbor of ours had a 73-case combine. I forgot what model number was because I was a kid. A four-row head case combine had a slant six Chrysler in it. The thing was as sweet as could be. But anyway, I remember that a lot of the advertising for diesel-powered equipment, and also at that same time, trucks were transitioning from spark ignition engines, gasoline engines, to diesel engines. And maybe 10 or 15 years later, in the 70s, when diesels were starting to come out in automotive applications, namely the Oldsmobile diesel, but there were other diesels. Volkswagen came out with a diesel. Peugeot, they're not here anymore. They're supposed to be joining with Chrysler now, so maybe they'll come back. Peugeot, a French company, had a lot of diesels. And that was prompted by the energy crisis of 1974. But the common denominator from what the tractor industry, the farm equipment manufacturers, the truck manufacturers, and then the personal use vehicle, automobile manufacturers, they had a common advertising theme. And they usually spoke about the efficiency of a diesel engine, but they often spoke more about the lack of tune-ups and the lack of maintenance that the diesel engine required. Now, keep in mind that this was at a time when gasoline engines had breaker points, and then maybe in the mid-1970s went to electronic ignition, but breaker points, a condenser, and a carburetor. So the gasoline engines were very, very service intensive. You had to clean the carburetor, you had to adjust the carburetor, you had to change the breaker points. So all that came into play, and they would advertise the diesel comp, the people that were trying to push diesel technology would say no tune-ups. I remember even Volkswagen had a, would have nothing to do with diesel, but they had an ad in the late 60s or early 70s because they were air-cooled, and they went on the square-back Volkswagen, a square-back and fast-back. They called them Type 3s. They had went to fuel injection. So I remember showing this ad to my father. I think it was in Popular Mechanics or Popular Science magazine. And the ad for the Volkswagen fastback said, no carburetor. It said, no radiator, no fan, no water pump, no coolant. And it was something else. And I said, geez, how can this thing run? And he explained to me that it was an air-cooled engine and it had fuel injection in lieu of a carburetor. So the diesel people, or the people pushing diesel is a better way for me to say it, were trying to drive home the fact that you did not have to truly have a, it wasn't a maintenance intensive engine. You put fuel in it, change the oil and some filters, and away you go. Because the injection pump, once it was set, you weren't going to set it again for the life of the engine. Back then, there really was not a problem with the injectors. Maybe 10,000 hours later or 500,000 miles later, problem with the injector. But there really wasn't much going on there. So it was you change your filters, your fuel and water separator, change the oil, and that's it. No real maintenance. As far as valve adjustment was concerned, well, that's more of an engine factor than the fuel type, the type of fuel it runs on. So that may have been, but they really pushed the fact that there was no tune-up. And then the diesel engine stayed like that, whereas we would call it a pump line nozzle engine. It stayed like that. And then the gasoline engine started to advance more and eventually got to the point where it also was fuel injected. They did away with the distributor, did away with the breaker point. So in essence, what had happened was that the gasoline engine over time became less sensitive to maintenance, or less maintenance, less demanding of maintenance. And then the diesel engine actually kind of flip-flopped with the gasoline engine, because you have the modern diesel engine in a light-duty pickup truck, and it's almost a polar opposite of what was back years ago. And excuse me, I just cleared my throat. But whereas today's gasoline engines, in essence, you hardly do anything to them, but the light-duty diesel is the complete opposite of what was first touted 30, 40 years ago. It became much more maintenance, demanding of maintenance. So that is what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the light-duty diesel and the modern light-duty diesel and the need to perform a tune-up on it. But a tune-up is going to be different than it was on a gasoline engine years ago. There's no spark plugs, there's no breaker points, there's no distributor. And I'm going to skip the fact about changing the filters. I think everybody that's listening to this show realizes that there's an air filter, there's a fuel filter, there's a fuel water separator that needs to be maintained. So that hasn't changed. But what we're going to do is we're going to discuss the other aspects of what you need to do to keep that light duty diesel in a pickup truck or van, SUV, at tip top performance, the greatest efficiency, and also the minimal amount of maintenance cost. So that is what the key is, because as I said, in the bushels and cents, it's not what you make, it's what you keep. And, you know, you don't want to put a lot of money into unnecessary repairs in this pickup truck, because if you've had the misfortune of having to do that, to put a major repair or even a minor repair on those engines, is that everything starts with at least four digits. You're not opening that hood for less than $1,000. And usually it goes almost up to five digits. If you wipe out the injection pump, the with the common rail system and the injectors, you're talking $5,000-$7,000. I mean, and if the turbo was bad, you're talking a few thousand dollars. So the thing basically is that they went from being so forgiving to becoming a very demanding mistress. And now, granted, these new diesels, whether it's the Ford Powerstroke, the Cummins in the Ram, or the Duramax in the General Motors products, I'm not going to deny that they're sweet running engines. They make a ton of power. They get great fuel economy for what they produce and the power they produce. And they're quiet. I mean, they're just very, very, very highly refined and defined engines, refined and defined engines. But that, to achieve that, came with a great level of complexity, and also made them to a certain extent a prima donna. It's like I grow sweet corn. You know, I go to these seminars and I listen to people talk, and they tell you, well, you know, you should pick out this hybrid, this and that. And they're talking all about field corn. And, you know, that's great, but you can't do that with sweet corn, because people are eating sweet corn. So taste, flavor, everything has to come into play. I can't pick a hybrid based upon its cold weather tolerance like a field corn guy can. So a lot of guys say, oh, I planted in April when the ground is real cold, but I put this and this and I put this seed treatment on, and the seed is, you know, very tolerant to cold weather, cold soil. Well, sweet corn is a darn prima donna. I mean, it's a very, very, very demanding mistress. And if you treat it right, it really, really, you know, pulls for you. But it's very, very unforgiving. So the light duty diesel is the same way. I mean, when it bites you hard, buddy. I mean, it'll take a good chunk out of you. So what I want to try to do in this show is give you some tips that will allow you to do some very easy maintenance on these engines that will improve its efficiency, its performance, and its longevity. So the first thing that I want to discuss with you is voltage sensitivity. Whereas you had an old pump line nozzle diesel engine, it could give a damn less whether you took the battery and the alternator out and threw it in a ditch. All right, once it got going, it was compression ignition, and it had no computer on it. It was strictly all mechanical. So the modern Tier 3 and Tier 4, the modern light-duty diesel common rail injection system, computer controlled, no mechanical controls, computer controlled, is very, very, very voltage sensitive. So forgetting about, we did a show on charging circuits and stuff a while back, but you know, it's going to be very sensitive to alternator output. So if you have a diode that's going bad in the alternator, it's going to definitely affect how it runs, because years ago they used to say with computers, garbage in, garbage out. Well, if you're putting unrectified AC into that microprocessor, that ECU, that engine control unit, and a dirty signal, then what's going to happen is it will impact the decision-making process and how that engine runs. But that's more of a component. That's really not a tune-up type of thing. So, but I did want to establish that. But the what I do want to bring up is that as a battery gets older, most of these have dual batteries, and the cells become sulfated in that battery. So it's called sulfated. What will actually happen is they'll build a almost like a plaque in your arteries. It'll build sulfur onto the plates and will make the battery less effective and less efficient. So a sulfated cell in a battery will drive or cause a light duty diesel to not have its full potential performance. And I'm not saying maybe the full horsepower, but it will run raggy. It has the potential of running raggy. It has the potential of not starting easily. It would be like an old gasoline motor. Just this thing needs a tune up. So it would be a little bit lazy, maybe not as responsive. So keep in mind that a sulfated battery, a battery that's already on its way out, it's not dead, it still cranks it, it's on its way out, will have the potential to impact how this light-duty diesel runs. So what part of your tune-up regimen or procedure should be is to have the battery / batteries in a light-duty diesel every 3 or 4 years load tested. And a load test, which used to use a carbon pile, they may do it a little bit differently now in a modern machine. They put a load; it puts a load on the battery and puts an amperage load, which is usually 50% of its cold cranking amps, and monitors the voltage output of the battery. So if it's a 900 amp battery, then you need to put 50. It'll put 50. The machine, you'll set the machine to put the load tester to put for approximately 450 amps, and that battery should maintain above 10.6 volts with 450 amps. And the thing is that if that battery doesn't maintain that, then it is on its way out and being sulfated. Now, interestingly enough, is that usually a sulfated battery has a higher at rest voltage than 12.6 volts. And we won't get into that now, but something you know. So the thing basically is part of your tune-up regimen, and this doesn't need to be done yearly, probably 3, 4, 5 years out, you want to load test the batteries and make sure that they are up to full capacity, because the system is going to monitor the alternator output and the charging voltage and all the decisions to run that tier 4 motor. The gasoline to run that tier 4 motor is voltage, and that voltage is going to come from the alternator through the battery. So anything that is skewing there will impact the way the engine runs and its performance. The other thing, which is common sense, is dirty terminals and dirty grounds. That the light duty diesel is not going to be forgiving of dirty battery terminals and dirty grounds. So your first tune-up procedure is to make sure that the batteries are up to snuff and that the connections are all clean. The next thing is that whereas an older diesel pump line nozzle used a injection pump, what's going to happen on this and on a modern engine, they're going to take a whole suite of sensors. And these sensors are going to take data in what's happening with the engine, and it is going to make a decision process. And one of the decision processes is how long to open the injectors and when to open them. And one of the main components of that is what is called the mass airflow sensor. And it's a sister of what is used on a gasoline engine. And so the mass airflow sensor is in the intake duct, and it's usually going to be after the turbocharger and before the throttle body. And we're going to discuss that in a second. That sensor is going to read the mass of the incoming air. and it's going to use that to determine load on the engine and to fuel and time the engine. Whereas a spark ignition engine has the timing of the spark plug, with a diesel, it's going to be the timing or when in the crankshaft's arc of rotation that the injector pulse is going to be initiated. The fuel pulse is going to be initiated. So now what you have to do is you have to make sure that there are no leaks prior or after the mass airflow sensor, but specifically after the mass airflow sensor, because air would be introduced into the engine that the sensor is not monitoring, and that is called false air. Also, what happens is that the sensors have an element in it, a sensing unit, that's why I call it a sensor, right? Because I don't want to use the same word twice, but it's the easiest way to describe it. And this sensing wire, the sensing element, becomes polluted just from impurities in the air. I mean, it could be from smog, it could be from dust, what have you. And what you need to do is that you need to take that sensor out and you need to spray it with a proper cleaner. Now, it needs to be a mass airflow sensor cleaner. And so what you do during your tune-up, you're going to make sure all of the clamps are snug. You're going to inspect the hoses for no leaks. The clamps are snug. You're going to remove the mass airflow sensor cleaner, a mass airflow sensor, and you're going to spray it. You're going to bathe it, wash it. It looks like a can of carburetor cleaner, but don't use carburetor cleaner or brake clean. It's mass airflow sensor cleaner. And a company called CRC was one of the first ones to actually do this or make a product like that. And that's the one I use, but there are other brands also. And it's going to wash the contaminants off that mass airflow sensor element, the sensing element, so it could accurately determine the load. That's a key. Now, do it all on your gasoline engines also, but on your light-duty diesel, that is going to be very important for you to have proper everything, starting, drivability, performance, fuel economy, emissions, what have you. Because if that sensor is skewed because of dirt, that's like reading something with a busted micrometer. The reading, or looking outside in a thermometer that's wrong, not busted, but wrong. So you say, oh, it's not, look at that, it's 72 degrees out and it's snowing. Well, obviously that's not the case, right? So the snow is telling you it's not 72 degrees, maybe it's 27. So you take that out, you buy a can of that cleaner when you're in town. It's about $8 for the can. It'll probably last you 2 years. So take that. That's part of your tune-up regimen, is to clean the mass airflow sensor. The next thing is that the modern diesel has a throttle body. Years ago, a diesel had no throttle. When you were moving the throttle lever or the gas pedal or the hand throttle on a tractor, you were moving a lever inside. You were changing the fueling in the injector pump. But a modern diesel has a throttle body akin to a gasoline engine. And that throttle plate will get dirty because of EGR, exhaust gas recirculation, and then overlap from the camshaft. So it is imperative that you keep that throttle plate clean. And what you would need to do is you would need to remove the intake duct. I usually do this when I'm doing the mass airflow sensor, so I have to take things apart twice. And you will have the engine off, obviously take the intake duct off. You get a clean rag, and you could buy a can of throttle body cleaner. Most cleaners today are carburetor / throttle body cleaner. And you'd spray the throttle body, and I would take a clean rag and clean the throttle bore and open the throttle plate. It's going to be drive-by-wire. We did a show on that a month or two back. It's going to be drive-by-wire, but you could actually take the throttle plate and push it open with your finger, and you're going to spray in there, and you want to keep that throttle plate clean so that when it actually is closed, it's not closing prematurely because it doesn't have gum and built up on it. And when it's at 1% throttle angle, it's still passing air. Not where the throttle plate actually, the bore actually becomes smaller and the throttle plate becomes larger when it gets sludge and gum on it. So like a carburetor. So you want to keep that clean. So you're going to clean the mass airflow sensor, then you're going to clean the throttle body, and you're going to go around this whole engine as part of your tune-up. And what you're going to do is you're going to make sure everything is snug on the intake track and what have you. So you just snug up all the bolts, the clamps, and that's it. So make sure there's no false air, no air leaks. The next thing that I suggest that you do is inspect the EGR valve. You don't have to take it off, inspect the EGR valve, but it's very, very important. Most of these engines have it's a cooled EGR. If you look back in the archives, I did a show on EGR, exhaust gas recirculation. And because these engines are so EGR dependent for oxides of nitrogen emission reduction, that they have a cooled EGR. Now, in most applications that I've seen, and maybe there's one that isn't, that it has a separate cooling system for the EGR. So it does not use the engine coolant to cool the EGR. And what will happen there is that you want to make sure that you service that coolant. And people are good about servicing the coolant on the engine, but they're not good about servicing the coolant on the EGR system. And you need to service that coolant, because otherwise what's going to happen, that heat exchanger for the EGR is going to fail, and you're going to have the potential of getting a coolant leak into the engine. And depending upon the coolant leak, you either have steam or you could actually hydrolock the engine. So the thing basically is, part of your tune-up procedure is to make sure that the coolant is up to snuff in the EGR circuit. And then if you want to, you could also look at the EGR and take the EGR valve off and clean it. But that's maybe 100, 150,000 miles. You're not going to do this every year with the EGR. But you want to always, don't forget about that coolant. So like I said, things are a little bit different. These diesels. It's not a one-to-one with tuning up an old 72 Ford gasoline engine. The other thing that I want you to always use is to treat your fuel with a additive that has multiple modes of action, like a herbicide that has multiple modes of action. And I want you to use an injector cleaner, because the injectors will build deposits. Now, I know I hear somebody saying, I use premium diesel fuel. Well, even if you use premium diesel fuel, I'm not going to deny that premium diesel fuel is a much higher quality, a better product. It's got a different additive package than run-of-the-mill diesel fuel. But the fact is that that fuel becomes corrupted from it leaves that refinery, that premium diesel fuel refinery, the leaves before it gets to your farm. Of course, it goes in through transportation, goes through multiple different storage tanks, is hot and cold, wicks in moisture, wicks in dirt. The guy's filling a tank, it's raining, it's snowing, he leaves the cap off, what have you. So I suggest, I love a premium diesel fuel as a base product, but I also like to additize that above that, just like, you know, to make an analogy to crops, I use Acuron, right, as a pre-emergence weed killer. But then, you know, everybody, you know, Syngenta and other people told me, you know, to heat that Acuron up a little bit with a pint or two per acre of atrazine. So yeah, I'm using a great product, Acuron, but now I'm heating it up a little bit. I'm dolling it up with a little bit of atrazine in there. So use a premium diesel. I commend you for using a premium diesel. I love a premium diesel, but don't think that you don't need to put any additives in it beyond that, because the main reason is that fuel has becomes corrupted in transit before it gets to your farm. So it's very important for you to keep the injectors clean, because that's where it's all about. Just like about a gasoline engine, if you're not breaking that fuel apart, if you're not delivering that fuel and atomizing that fuel properly inside that engine, then all bets are off on how that engine is going to run. And that is a constant tune-up procedure. So additize your fuel for lubricity, because you don't want the high pressure pump and the injectors to wear, because of moisture and a lack of lubricity in the fuel. And you have to remember, as I said, if that fuel gets some moisture in during transit, you've killed the lubricity in it, whatever little lubricity it had. So, and you want to keep those injectors clean so they have a constant spray pattern, so they're spraying as designed. And that is the most important thing. That's that in the mass airflow sensor is going to be paramount to your tune-up of this engine. And if it's a Huey type of engine, which uses oil, high pressure engine oil, and to operate the injector, then you want to use some sort of stiction reducer or stiction eliminator in the engine oil. And this Hot Shot is one brand, there's a number of brands now, because that injector has a fuel side and an oil side. And they're both very, very important to keep that engine running properly. So part of your tune-up procedure would be to always keep the fuel additized. And then if it's a Huey system, every once in a while, every few thousand, every 1,000 hours, 2,000 hours, whatever, if it's a road truck, what have you, all right, do you want to put that that stiction, anti-stiction treatment in the oil. Now, keep in mind that I don't know of a light-duty diesel, Tier 4 modern diesel, that has a Huey injector. There's none. There is none. The older Power Strokes, which are an which had a Huey system prior to going to a piezo injector. Some people call it piezo, some people call it piezo. Piezo type of injector, which is a completely different internal design than a Huey system. But the idea of keeping the injector pintle clean from deposits by putting an in-tank fuel additive is just as paramount with a piezo as it is with a Huey. But with a Huey, so an older Power Stroke, the original Power Strokes had a Huey injector in it, and you would have to put that additive, that stiction additive into the oil and follow the procedure. You run it for so long and then you dump the oil out of it. Then, you know, keep in mind also, you know, we'll divest for a second, is that, you know, a lot of farm equipment uses, a lot of cat engines use Huey injectors. So, you know, the show today is about light duty diesel, but I want to be able to touch on things that can help you regardless. So you have an engine, you have like a Challenger, a cat Challenger, track tractor, that has a Huey system. You want to put that stiction chemical in that oil and keep the oil side of the injector functioning properly and not sticking. And they're just as important. And they're just as important to keep the injectors clean. But today we're talking about the light duty diesel. All right. The next thing that I want to explain to you is that many engines today are using a variable vane turbocharger. And what happens with the variable vane turbocharger is there's rings on the turbine side. And what it does is it tricks the turbo into thinking that it's smaller than it is. So to get quick spool up and quick throttle response, it acts like a smaller turbo. And then as power and airflow is needed, these vanes move. It's called the VVT, variable vane turbocharger. And they have a solenoid on it and they have a sensor. They're very, very reliable. And the only thing that comes into play, and this gets back to, you know, this is almost like, you know, nutrient tie up in crops. You say, well, I got this, you know, I got this fertility out here, but the crop looks lousy. It's not showing it because it's tied up. Well, the thing is that by you doing everything that I said right from the beginning, having good voltage, clean mass airflow sensor, clean throttle body, EGR, clean fuel injectors, treated fuel, you are going to end up building a minimal amount of carbon deposits on that VVT ring. And that means that VVT ring is going to go and it's going to slide and work and be in a position that it is supposed to be in for that load on the engine. And so if you do all of that, then you are going to have minimal maintenance on the VVT. If you don't do that, like if you don't brush your teeth or if you don't fertilize your crop properly and you mine all the fertility out of the soil, or you're constantly plowing and killing the soil structure, killing the microbes, killing the tilth of the soil, then you're not going to have good water infiltration. You're going to have your carbon, your magnesium calcium ratio is all off. The soil is going to get hard. It's going to puddle. It's going to do all this. It's going to compact. Well, same thing is going to happen with this. But keep in mind that VVT, those rings, over time, whether it's 100,000 miles or 300,000 miles, depending upon how good you are with everything else, is that you're going to have to take that turbine side, which is the hot side of the turbocharger, off, and you're going to have to take that housing off, and you're going to have to clean it and clean the carbon out of it so those rings move back and forth. There's a solenoid that moves it. We did a show a couple of weeks ago about solenoids. All right, so the thing is that you're going to need to do that. But my goal is that if you do everything else that I said up until this particular point, then the amount of carbon deposits on that VVT, unless you have a lot of short trip cycles and a lot of idling with this engine, is that will be very minimal. And you could probably go 250,000, 300,000 miles without having to remove that turbine housing and cleaning that variable vane rings. But keep in mind, that doesn't mean that you need a new turbocharger for $3,000. It means that, you know, that the rings are carboned up. So if it sets a trouble code for it, or the power is down, or it's real lazy where it doesn't want to build boost because the rings it put feels good upstairs, or it feels good downstairs and the power ramps off down upstairs when you put a load on, it's because those rings are most likely carboned up. So it's something to keep in mind. But the goal is, like the Strategic Air Command, their goal was to never have to fire a shot, right? So your goal is to do everything else on this tune-up procedure so you never have to take that turbocharger apart. And then the last thing that I want to discuss is that, unlike diesels before, believe it or not, the modern diesel has an oxygen sensor, at least one oxygen sensor. And that is used as a overseer to what's happening. It's used a lot for e-job, for the fuel delivery. So keep in mind that an oxygen sensor, then again, if you do everything I said and have good combustion and every what have you inside the engine, you're not, the EGR cooler is not putting antifreeze into the combustion chamber and coating the sensor with silica, but the oxygen sensor is considered a consumable, just like on a gasoline engine. So the thing is that, keep in mind, that's the auditor, that's the accountant. It's going to tell the computer whether things are going right or wrong. So over time, you will need to replace that oxygen sensor. The $64,000 question is when you'll need to do it. As I said, you know, a second ago, depends upon the use of the vehicle and how well you keep everything else. But probably if you get to 100, 150,000 miles on this engine, it probably would not be a bad idea to put a new oxygen sensor in it, just because, like a tire, it's going to wear it. It doesn't wear it. It degrades. It does what they call skews, that it's no longer in calibration. But you would want, and if the engine is idling a lot, or you're using a truck to feed cattle or short trips, then maybe you want to put it in less than 100,000 miles. But I do strongly recommend that you go to the dealer and buy an OE oxygen sensor, original equipment, because a lot of the aftermarket oxygen sensors are not calibrated for a particular piece of equipment. They use a generic calibration, and it kind of screws everything up, or has the potential to do that. So let's recap. Your tune-up, you want to be, you realize that the system is voltage sensitive, the batteries are good, not sulfated, the connections are clean. You want to clean the mass airflow sensor, you want to clean the throttle body. You want to make sure the EGR cooler has the proper maintenance as far as its coolant is concerned. You want to make sure all your induction hoses are tight so there's no false air getting into the engine. You want to put a fuel injector cleaner in it. If it's a Huey system, you want to put an oil cleaner in it also, a stiction element, and so a fuel cleaner, injector cleaner will go in the tank, and a stiction product will go into the oil. Follow the instructions, because you don't want to keep that in there with the stiction product too long. You want to treat your fuel, even if you're using premium fuel. You want to be cognizant that if you do everything right, that there'll be a minimum amount of carbon built on the variable vane of the turbocharger. But if the engine starts to feel lazy or feel different, perform differently, there's a very good possibility that those vanes, those rings, is starting to stick. And over time, you're going to have to change that oxygen sensor as a maintenance item. So that is it. I would clean the mass airflow sensor and the throttle body every time that you do an oil change on that truck. The other things, you'll go around, snug stuff up, put eyeballs on it. Maybe after 3 or 4 years, check the batteries, put eyeballs on the cable, treat your fuel with every tank. If you always treat the fuel and it has an injector cleaner in there, then you won't have to worry about it. If you're using an additive, a lubricity additive in an anti-gel, it doesn't have an injector cleaner, then treat it every oil change with a high dose of injector cleaner. Follow the instructions with Huey, with the stiction product. That usually doesn't need to be done too often, but you don't want to let those deposits build up, because then they will not be able to come loose. Already, and they will not be able to be freed. And that's basically it. So it's really not a lot of maintenance, but it's maintenance that needs to be done for you to be able to get a best performance, minimal emissions, minimal amount of regens. We'd even talk about that minimal amount of regens and make this a trouble-free engine for 200,000-300,000 miles, and most importantly, reliable with a minimal amount of downtime and expense. And that's what it's all about. I don't want you to be putting money into something $7,000-$8,000 for injectors and a common rail pump because you didn't additize the fuel. So I don't want that. I want you to put that into your farm where it makes your money. All righty? So that is it. If you have any questions, any concerns, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And now we are going to go into our toolbox test question. We're still on test number two, and it's going to be question number two. But first, we're going to have Tex Rubinowitz from Ripsaw Records. He's the hot rod man, and he knows all about tuning things up good. So come on, Tex, let's tune this baby up. Let's go.
Well, I'm a rolling daddy with a mean machine. It's got a V8 motor, and it sure is clean. I'm a hot rod man. Yeah, I'm a hot rod man. Look out, little mama, gonna get you.
Thank you, Tex. That's Tex Rubinowitz, as I said, the hot rod man on Ripsaw Records, who will very shortly have a new website. And I will tell you about that. And you could go there and hear the whole song. I only play like 20 seconds of it, but I think the song is like a little bit more than 2 minutes. It really is a great tune. All righty. So we're on toolbox test number two, question two. And as I always say, don't worry about whether it's Farmer A, B, or C. Worry about what the right answer is. All right, you finally have the chance to go into town and get new tires for your wife's SUV. When the tire shop pulls off the front wheels, they notice that only the outside brake pad on the left caliper is almost metal to metal. The shop owner suggests installing only new pads since the rotors look good. He says that with your vehicle, it is very easy since the pads slide in from the top without having to remove the caliper. You give the go-ahead, and the work is done. Is the problem solved, or will the one pad wear prematurely again? Okay, Farmer A states that all disc brake pads wear unevenly, and there is nothing you can do about it. Farmer B says that the brake rotor is uneven and wearing out the one pad faster. Farmer C says that the caliper is not returning, and the one pad is always rubbing slightly. And Farmer D tells you that the piston in the caliper is leaking and only the one pad is stopping the SUV. So basically, you pull the tires off of new tires, the one pad on the caliper, the outside brake pad on the left caliper is almost metal to metal. That wore out. The other pads still look good. So you're going to have to tell me which farmer is right. But first, we're going to have our special delivery section. And special delivery is brought to us by Firestone Ag. And they're a company that was founded by Harvey Firestone. And, you know, as I said before, you know, that mindset that was that Harvey Firestone had to put the farmer on pneumatic tires is still alive today in Firestone Ag. And, it, you know, it's represented by their 23-degree tread bar, their new Evo line of tires, the AD2 technology, which is the IF and VF tires, and then also the new line of replacement tracks, the Firestone of tracks. You know, the soil, you know, like we were talking about before, the soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. And I'm going to challenge you. When you need tires, I know you don't, it's not something you buy every day, but when you need tires, I'm going to challenge you to go look at the Firestone Ag offerings. And I would be very, very, very surprised if once you looked at them with an open mind that you did not become a Firestone farm. And as they say, farm hard. So that's what we want you to do. All righty, so our a special delivery letter. I have to get the right thing here. I don't have the right thing. Okay, this is not the right paper. That's not good. Okay, what I do with it? Here, ready? If you hear my paper shuffling around here, that's what I'm doing. I have my letter here. All right, this microphone picks up everything. So prior to this, I was very paranoid about making any noise, but now I figured, hey, I'd rather give you a good show and don't worry about a little paper noise. All right, so this is the letter. And I printed this one out with a larger font so I could read it. Hello and greeting from Zimbabwe. Well, that's great. The gentleman's from Africa. I found your website and podcast about 6 months ago and has become a true learning experience for me and those that work on my family's plantation. I hope that you can help with a problem I am having with a 1972 Fargo 100 pickup truck with a slant six. It was made in Michigan, but was shipped to Africa via Chrysler Canada when new, and it was badged as a Fargo instead of a Dodge, but is the same. As an aside to that, I know I have a lot of listeners up in Canada. They're definitely familiar with the Fargo line. We never truly had that in the United States, but there was, and I don't know what the politics of it was, but they were Dodge trucks made in the United States, and they were badged as Fargos. They were 100% the same, except staying Dodges at Fargo. So back to his letter. My family purchased the truck new in 1971, and it had always been in our plantation. Recently, it tends to burn ignition points at a rapid rate. About 1 year ago, I replaced the ballast resistor since it failed. The engine runs fine, but the breaker points only last about 3 months and fail. If you have any thoughts, please share them with me, since the truck is used daily and it is an important part of our business, and I am tired of changing the points. I don't blame you. Slant 6 was a pain in the neck. I always had to pull the distributors out because I'm nearsighted in one eye, as I said, and farsighted in the other. Plus, I have 2400 vision one eye, so I can never see in there to put the screws and the points and put the fuel gauge in. So he's tired of changing the points before they would last about 2 years. And his name is John Castle, and he's from Zimbabwe, Africa. And I want to thank you so much for listening from there. And that sounds like a really sweet truck. It's been in your family since 1971, 1972 Fargo. What I would say to you, sir, my thought is that the ballast resistor that you changed does not have enough resistance in it. And you didn't mention anything about changing the coil. So I'm assuming it's the original coil or a coil that worked fine prior to you having this problem with the points. And I would say that the ballast resistor does not have enough resistance, and it's putting too much voltage through the breaker points, and that's why they're burning out prematurely. Now, the best thing for you to do, and I tried to look, and I didn't have a spec for an old Chrysler breaker point system, but something tells me that they're probably about a half a ohm resistance. But what you could do is put a new set of points in, and with the key on engine off, check the resistance of the ballast. And if I happen to find a specification on a 1972 ballast, I will email you, because I have your email address, and let you know. But the other thing that you could do, so you want to check the ballast resistance, you unplug it and just go across it with an ohm meter, and then you want to plug that back in, and you want to check the voltage on the positive side of the coil. So the ballast, the ignition, the voltage comes through the ballast and goes to the positive side of the coil, and then the breaker points go to the negative side of the coil. So what you would do is you would start the slant six up, you'd put a voltmeter on the positive terminal, positive end of the voltmeter on the positive terminal of the coil, and then you would ground the other end of the voltmeter, and you would run the engine, and you would see the voltage with the proper resistance, which I believe is around a half ohm, but I may be wrong. You would probably have about 7 to 8 volts on the ignition coil, going to the ignition coil, and you're probably going to find that you have 9 or 10 volts there. To tell you the truth, it'll run really great with 9 or 10 volts to the coil, but the points will not last. And I really think that you just have a ballast that is made incorrectly and does not have enough resistance to drop that voltage down to about 7 to 8 volts, which is the sweet spot to get enough coil saturation to have the engine perform properly, but to also give breaker point life. you know, and years ago, when you know guys are hot rodding cars, they would take the ballast out and they would run full voltage to the coil, to the breaker points. They would burn up very quickly. I mean, not 3 months. They wouldn't run the motor for 3 months. They'd burn up in a couple of runs at the drag strip, or if it was a roundy round type of dirt track car, it would burn up quickly, but you get a lot more coil saturation. So I think that's why your truck runs fine. It probably actually runs a little bit better, but you could confirm that by the voltage at the coil. And if you cannot find the spec, or I can't find the spec on the ballast resistor, check yours. See if you can get another one. Check that one. But the end result will be what voltage is going to the coil. That's the end of the line. So if you get around 7-8 volts to the coil, and I wouldn't be surprised if you have 9-10, close to 11 volts now, then your point life will go back up and you could have that Dodge serve you for many, 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 many more years. All righty? So if you have any questions on that, please contact me. And thank you so much for listening all the way from Zimbabwe, Africa. And now we're going to go back to our toolbox test as we get ready to close the show. And remember, you had a caliper that was wearing one pad on the outside. So I'm going to get you the response here. So let's see what we have here. All righty. So let me get to the proper page, which is not good here. I'm flipping a lot of papers around today. Okay. So Farmer C is correct. Farmer C knows the reason why the outside pad is worn. A brake caliper with only one piston is a floating design. And last week we did a show on, or a week or two, we did a show on brakes. A floating design and needs to return when the brake pedal is released. The hydraulic piston, the inner pad, is returning, but the pins or bracket that the caliper floats on is either dirty, rusty, or lacks lubrication. The outside pad is dragging slightly. Since the shop owner only slid in new pads, the problem will still be present. The outside pad will drag since the proper procedure of taking the caliper off, cleaning, lubricating the slide points, the movement points, was not performed. So all he basically did was put a new set of pads in, and you are going to have uneven wear. So that is the answer. So whenever you look at a brake caliper, you need to have even wear. So listen, I'm going to thank you so much for listening to me today. So listen, right? Listening to me, the Hot Rod Farmer. And I want to thank you for letting me share a little bit about Warren County and our agricultural community here and how rural it is, even though it's the most populated state in New Jersey, the most populated state. And I want you to know that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved, beloved America. So you have a great week, and listen, and please tune in next week. Thank you so much. Have a blessed day. Bye-bye.